It was through this fatal paradox in the nature of things that all these modern adventurers come at last to a sort of tedium and acquiescence. They desired strength, and to them, to desire strength was to admire strength. To admire strength was simply to admire the statu quo. They thought that he who wished to be strong ought to respect the strong. They did not realize the obvious verity that he who wishes to be strong must despise the strong. They sought to be everything, to have the whole force of the cosmos behind them, to have an energy that would drive the stars. But they did not realize the two great facts. First, that in the attempt to be everything, the first and most difficult step is to be something. Second, that the moment a man is something, he is essentially defying everything. The lower animals, say the men of science, fought their way up with a blind selfishness. If this be so, the only real moral of it is that our unselfishness, if it is to triumph, must be equally blind. The mammoth did not put his head on one side and wonder whether mammoths were a little out of date. Mammoths were at least as much up to date as that individual mammoth could make them. The great elk did not say, "Cloven hoofs are very much worn now." He polished his own weapons for his own use. But in the reasoning animal, there has arisen a more horrible danger, that he may fail through perceiving his own failure. When modern sociologists talk of the necessity of accommodating oneself to the trend of the time, they forget that the trend of the time, at its best, consists entirely of people who will not accommodate themselves to anything. At its worst, it consists of many millions of frightened creatures, all accommodating themselves to a trend that is not there. And that is becoming more and more the situation of modern England. Every man speaks of public opinion and means by public opinion minus his opinion. Every man makes his contribution negative under the erroneous impression that the next man's contribution is positive. Every man surrenders his fancy to a general tone which is itself a surrender. And over all the heartless and fatuous unity spreads this new and wearisome and platitudinous press, incapable of invention, incapable of audacity, capable only of a servility all the more contemptible because it is not even a servility to the strong. But all who beg with force and conquest will end in this. The chief characteristic of the new journalism is simply that it is bad journalism. It is beyond all comparison the most shapeless, careless, and colorless work done in our day. I read yesterday a sentence which should be written in letters of gold and adamant. It is the very motto of the new philosophy of empire. I found it, as the reader has already eagerly guessed, in Pearson's magazine, while I was communing soul to soul with Mr. C. Arthur Pearson, whose first and suppressed name, I am afraid, is Chilperic. It occurred in an article on the American presidential election. This is a sentence, and everyone should read it carefully and roll it on the tongue till all the honey be tasted. Quote, "A little sound common sense often goes further with an audience of American workingmen than much high-flown argument. A speaker who, as he brought forward his points, hammered nails into the board, won hundreds of votes for his side at the last presidential election." End of quote. I do not wish to soil this perfect thing with comment. The words of Mercury are harsh after the songs of Apollo. But just think for a moment of the mind, the strange, inscrutable mind, of the man who wrote that, of the editor who approved it, of the people who are probably impressed by it, of the incredible American working man, of whom, for all I know, it may be true. Think of what their notion of common sense must be. It is delightful that you and I, now able to win thousands of votes, should we ever be engaged in a presidential election, by doing something of this kind, for I suppose the nails and the board are not essential to the exhibition of common sense. There may be variations. We may read, quote, "A little common sense impresses American working men more than high-flown argument. A speaker who, as he made his points, pulled buttons off his waistcoat, won thousands of votes for his side, end of quote. Or, quote, common sense tells better in America than high-flown argument. Thus, Senator Budge, who threw his false teeth in the air every time he made an epigram, won the solid approval of American working men, end of quote. Or again, quote, the sound common sense of a gentleman from Earlswood who stuck straws in his hair during the progress of his speech assured the victory of Mr. Roosevelt, end of quote. There are many other elements in this article on which I should love to linger, but the matter which I wish to point out is that in that sentence is perfectly revealed the whole truth of what our Chamberlainites, hustlers, bustlers, empire builders, and strong silent men really mean by common sense. They mean knocking with deafening noise and in dramatic effect meaningless bits of iron into a useless bit of wood. A man goes on to an American platform and behaves like a mountebank fool with a board and a hammer. Well, I do not blame him. I might even admire him. He may be a dashing and quite decent strategist. He may be a fine romantic actor like Burke, flinging the dagger on the floor. He may even, for all I know, be a sublime mystic, profoundly impressed with the ancient meaning of the divine trade of the carpenter, and offering to the people a parable in the form of a ceremony. All I wish to indicate is the abyss of mental confusion in which such wild ritualism can be called sound common sense. And it is in that abyss of mental confusion, and in that alone, that the new imperialism lives and moves and has its being. The whole glory and greatness of Mr. Chamberlain consists in this, that if a man hits the right nail on the head, nobody cares where he hits it to or what it does. They care about the noise of the hammer, not about the silent drip of the nail. Before and throughout the African War, Mr. Chamberlain was always knocking in nails with ringing decisiveness. But when we ask, but what have these nails held together? Where is your carpentry? Where is your contented outlanders? Where is your free South Africa? Where is your British prestige? What have your nails done? Then, what answer is there? We must go back with an affectionate sigh to our Pearson for the answer to the question of what the nails have done. The speaker who hammered nails into a board won thousands of votes. Now, the whole of this passage is admirably characteristic of the new journalism which Mr. Pearson represents, the new journalism which has just purchased the Standard. To take one instance out of hundreds, the incomparable man with the board and nails is described in the Pearson's article as calling out, as he smote the symbolic nail, lie number one, nailed to the mast, nailed to the mast. In the whole office, there was apparently no compositor or office boy to point out that we speak of lies being nailed to the counter and not to the mast. Nobody in the office knew that Pearson's magazine was falling into a stale Irish bull, which must be as old as St. Patrick. This is the real and essential tragedy of the sale of the Standard. It is not merely that journalism is victorious over literature, it is that bad journalism is victorious over good journalism. It is not that one article which we consider costly and beautiful is being ousted by another kind of article which we consider common or unclean. It is that of the same article, a worse quality is preferred to a better. If you like popular journalism, as I do, you will know that Pearson's magazine is poor and weak popular journalism. You will know it as certainly as you know bad butter. You will know as certainly that it is poor popular journalism as you know that The Strand, in the great days of Sherlock Holmes, was good popular journalism. Mr. Pearson has been a monument of this enormous banality. About everything he says and does, there is something infinitely weak-minded. He clamors for home trades and employs foreign ones to print his paper. When this glaring fact is pointed out, he does not say that the thing was an oversight, like a sane man. He cuts it off with scissors like a child of three. His very cunning is infantile. And like a child of three, he does not cut it quite off. In all human records, I doubt if there is such an example of a profound simplicity and deception. This is the sort of intelligence which now sits in the seat of the sane and honorable old Tory journalism. If it were really the triumph of the tropical exuberance of the Yankee press, it would be vulgar, but still tropical. But it is not. We are delivered over to the bramble, and from the meanest of the shrubs comes the fire upon the cedars of Lebanon. The only question now is how much longer the fiction will endure that journalists of this order represent public opinion. It may be doubted whether any honest and serious tariff reformer would for a moment maintain that there was any majority for tariff reform in the country comparable to the ludicrous preponderance of money which has given it among the great dailies. The only inference is that for purposes of real public opinion, the press is now a mere plutocratic oligarchy. Doubtless, the public buys the wares of these men for one reason or another. But there is no more reason to suppose that the public admires their politics than that the public admires the delicate philosophy of Mr. Cross or the darker and sterner creed of Mr. Blackwell. If these men are merely tradesmen, there is nothing to say except that there are plenty like them in the Battersea Park Road, and many much better. But if they make any sort of attempt to be politicians, we can only point out to them that they are not as yet even good journalists.